Welcome back. Shall we finish this chapter tonight? Chapter 5, the ascent of the sacrifice, the first section, the works of knowledge, the psychic being. So in this first section of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo made a distinction between the lower knowledge, as important and significant as it might be, it is the aparavidya. The paravidya is the knowledge of the essential truth of existence, the truth of one's consciousness, the truth of one's experience, coming from a single undivided reality, which is expressed in a manifold way here, in which our soul, through its repeated experience, develops through the sap of that digestion a knowledge and understanding and mastery of the world that it comes to know and love and, in a sense, be sovereign through. Sovereign because the divine in us exerts its will through our surrendered personality, through our given being. So this giving is what marks the ascent of the sacrifice. It is the soul offering again and again at every level all that experiences and learns to the Supreme. And in that felt communion, the descent, the touch, the afflatus flows from above and brings consciousness and light and delight to us here. So we are far along in the chapter now. Sri Aurobindo has even been setting the idea in front of us, a potential that our lives turned towards divinity need not be solitary. Need not be the isolation of a sage in an illumined condition, but that we can work in solidarity with the world around, that we can enjoy and grow in a collective yoga that benefits the cosmos. But something in us is irrepressibly turned towards the discovery, the secrets of our own existence and the secrets of the cosmos. And that now, Sri Aurobindo turns to in these last pages and gives full voice to it. So, look at this next sentence. Wonderful. It is the very nature of the soul or the psychic being to turn towards the divine truth as the sunflower to the sun. It accepts and clings to all that is divine or progressing towards divinity and draws back from all that is a perversion or a denial of it, from all that is false and undivine. So Sri Aurobindo makes here a quick and easy identification between the soul and the psychic being. Now, when we get to the life divine, which, remember, he revised and published about a decade, let's say, several years anyway, after he was revising these chapters of the Synthesis of Yoga, he makes some demarcations there, some subtler distinctions. We won't go into them here. We studied the life divine. But it's interesting to note the mellifluous language here is expressing in a central way what he took pages to unroll in the life divine. And he continues, yet the soul is at first but a spark and then a little flame of Godhead burning in the midst of a great darkness. For the most part, it is veiled in its inner sanctum, and to reveal itself, it has to call on the mind, the life force, and the physical consciousness, and persuade them as best they can to express it. Ordinarily, it succeeds at most in suffusing their outwardness with its inner light and modifying with its purifying fineness their dark obscurities or their coarser mixture. So it is a spark, and this brings us back to that great image in the Mundaka Upanishad, where it's describing the conscious reality of Brahman, the divine, as a central fire, a great central fire, which is throwing out thousands of sparks. And all of those sparks are identical in essence to that fire, but each enters into a journey, into the night, into the apparent obscurity of the universe. Each spark with a mission to alight and to catch fire on that which it touches and illuminates. Now, it becomes a flame. What is the flame in the Veda? It is Agni, the mystic fire, that which on the altar, on the Vedi, receives the offering, sets it alight, and carries it upwards into connectivity with, into communion with, as a giving to the divine powers that people the cosmos in ways seen and unseen. So that fire on that altar begins in a small way, but grows and becomes a flame, becomes conscious, and is the very power of the ascent. It came from that home. And in a way, it's going back to that home because it claims for all the divine experience, the entirety of this universe, and every experience that we have comes to it, and it finds inside the sap. It harvests the wheat and offers the grain. It has emotional experiences. It fashions ideas and takes those refined concepts and offers them. So whatever it is that is in the realm of our experience can become part of the gift. And the gift given allows the communion. It is received, there's a response. The call and the grace. We call, we offer, the grace comes back. So this is the idea, the inner mystical meaning of the sacrifice. And the soul is the very picture of that, because it wants to wander through the world, tasting this, touching that. Every sense represents a different aspect of its reach. And all the senses report back to the mind, and the mind reports back to the soul, and the soul offers and gives. And so there's a roundedness to the idea of a sacrifice, but it's not a sacrifice torn away from us, it's a joyful giving. That's the idea in the yajna, that it is a gift. So you might see that here Sri Aurobindo describes that it begins as a spark, then becomes a little flame, as it says in the Mundaka Upanishad, and then calls on the mind, the life force, and the body consciousness to share, to give. So the soul works through the subliminal nature, not necessarily through the most outward parts of our being, but those aspects, those vaults of our conscious being, which are behind the scenes a little bit. So we have a deep soul. We have these inner chambers of the inner mind, the inner life, and even the inner physical. And then we have the outer portion where our gaze is directed completely outwards. The gates are turned out. But if we turn our eyes inside, we come to these inner sections of our mind, life, and body, which then are in closer proximity to and in connection with the soul. So those the soul wants to touch first. wants to enliven and enlighten. So this you find described again in the Life Divine in chapter 23, in that, well, pardon me, maybe it's chapter 25. In the second book, it's the Triple Transformation. I think in chapter 23 in the first book, he gives some preliminary descriptions to the psychic in a section called, a chapter called The Double Soul in Man. But more beautifully said later in the Triple Transformation. Back to his text. Even when there is a formed psychic being able to express itself with some directness in life, it is still, in all but a few, a smaller portion of the being. Quote, no bigger in the mass of the body than the thumb of a man, end quote, was the image used by the ancient seers, and it is not always able to prevail against the obscurity or ignorant smallness of the physical consciousness, the mistaken surenesses of the mind, or the arrogance and vehemence of the vital nature. So this is a very famous passage, of course, in the Katha Upanishad. Depending on how you count it, let's say in the fourth chapter, the 12th and 13th verse, and then at the close of the entire Upanishad, in the sixth chapter, at the 17th verse, where he's describing the Angushtam Matra Antaratman, or the Angushtam Matra Purusha. No bigger than the thumb of a man, because it hasn't evolved and grown yet. This is an early experience. When we look for the soul, we find it. It's difficult to find because it's hidden behind the enormity of what we're thinking about, what we're wrestling with, and the circumstances of our life. So it seems to be just this tiny reality embedded inside. This also is found as an image in other texts, in the Taittiriya Aranyaka, for instance. It is there earlier than in the Upanishads. It's also in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad and in the Maitri Upanishad. Those of you who have read Savitri, Sri Aurobindo's great epic poem, may recall that episode where death comes to claim Satyavan. Well, I think it's in the Mahabharata, where Yama, coming to extract the soul of Satyavan, talks about reaching inside and taking this Purusha, the size of a thumb, from him. Just in a way that's very reminiscent of what we have here in the Upanishads. And of course, later that story becomes the ground in which Sri Aurobindo casts the whole picture of the universe for us as evolving spirits to see. So back to this psychic being. So there's a soul essence, there's a psychic entity, or essence, which develops into an entity and then into a psychic being, persuading the personality to accept its influence, all of which is described in the Life Divine, so you can go and read about that in the Triple Transformation. Here it's very simply put. This soul is obliged to accept the human mental, emotive, sensational life as it is, its relations, its activities, its cherished forms and figures. It has to labor to disengage and increase the divine element in all this relative truth mixed with the continual falsifying error, this love turned to the uses of the animal body or the satisfaction of the vital ego, this life of an average manhood, shot with rare and pale glimpses of godhead and the darker luridities of the demon and the brute. Unerring in the essence of its will, it is obliged often, under the pressure of its instruments, to submit to mistakes of action, wrong placement of feeling, wrong choice of person, errors in the exact form of its will, in the circumstances of its expression of the infallible inner ideal. Yet, is there a divination within it which makes it a surer guide than the reason, or than even the highest desire? And through apparent errors and stumblings, its voice can still lead better than the precise intellect and the considering mental judgment. This is given voice also in the Triple Transformation, that chapter in the Life Divine. So the soul, as it works its way through the ignorant nature that it inherits by dint of coming into the world, has slow going at first and can't persuade perfect obedience to its light, can't even find its way perfectly, but has a sure instinct, a kind of intuition, a feeling that this is the direction. And as it pursues it, it eventually wins. It cannot be suppressed. It will go through 1,000 defeats to get to the signal victory. This voice of the soul is not what we call conscience, for that is only a mental and often conventional erring substitute. It is a deeper and more seldom heard call. Yet, to follow it when heard is wisest. Even, it is better to wander at the call of one's soul than to go apparently straight with the reason and the outward moral mentor. But it is only when the life turns towards the divine that the soul can truly come forward and impose its power on the outer members. For itself, a spark of the divine, to grow in flame towards the divine is its true life and its very reason of existence. So many instances we can cite where the mother, in guiding a person's development, took them away from the ready, easy path, that which their background intended for them, and opened a path for the soul. Even in the life of the ashram, there are many occasions where people were put in posts of importance. They had no background. They had no readiness for the job, but she saw that their soul would flower if they could do this work. And she would take time to look into a situation when presented to her and offer her insight. So there's one anecdote that many of you are already familiar with, so I'll put it briefly, where there was a young lady who had suddenly developed an interest in a young man, an Indian girl, developed an interest in a young man and was going to horse races and things like that. And the parents were very concerned and outraged and wanted her to stop and wanted mother's word on the subject so they could use that. And mother said, send me a picture of what she looked like before and send me a picture of what she looks like now. They sent a picture, and she looked, before meeting this young man, she looked, you know, prim and obedient, but rather gray. The picture of when she was going about with this young fellow, Mother said she saw joy, light. She said, the soul is happy. This is not something that is in accord with the morality of the moment, but in this picture, the mother is saying that this girl is happier in this phase of her life than in that phase of her life. Stand aside, let her go. Difficult when you're a parent. But the soul is not obliged to follow the moral conventions of the mental human. It knows its way. At a certain stage in the yoga, when the mind is sufficiently quieted and no longer supports itself at every step on the sufficiency of its mental certitudes, when the vital has been steadied and subdued and is no longer constantly insistent on its own rash will, demand, and desire, when the physical has been sufficiently altered not to bury altogether the inner flame under the mass of its outwardness, obscurity, or inertia, an inmost being, long hidden within and felt only in its rare influences, is able to come forward and illumine the rest and take up the lead of the sadhana. Its character is a one-pointed orientation towards the divine or the highest, one-pointed and yet plastic in action and movement. It does not create a rigidity of direction like the one-pointed intellect or a bigotry of the regnant ruling idea or impulse like the one-pointed vital force. It is at every moment and with a supple sureness that it points its way to the truth, automatically distinguishes the right step from the false, extricates the divine or Godward movement from the clinging mixture of the undivine. Its action is like a searchlight showing up all that has to be changed in the nature. It has in it a flame of will, insistent on perfection, on an alchemic transmutation of all the inner and outer existence. It sees the divine essence everywhere, but rejects the mere mask and the disguising figure. It insists on truth, on will and strength and mastery, on joy and love and beauty, but on a truth of abiding knowledge that surpasses the mere practical momentary truth of the ignorance, on an inward joy and not on mere vital pleasure, for it prefers rather a purifying suffering and sorrow to degrading satisfactions, on love winged upward and not tied to the stake of egoistic craving or with its feet sunk in the mire, on beauty restored to its priesthood of interpretation of the eternal, on strength and will and mastery as instruments not of the ego, but of the spirit. Its will is for the divinization of life, the expression through it of a higher truth, its dedication to the divine and the eternal. So we can see that the powers of the soul as it emerges get to the essence of all the faculties that we have. At the base of all those faculties, the truth of all those faculties find their real foundation when connected back to this emerging soul. When we have that, then they find their justification. They find their fulfillment. So mind, life, vitality, body, affections, emotions, the luminousness of the thought, all get grounded in the real force of the divine being when they are merged in the soul consciousness. It is one-pointed. It is a searchlight. It insists. It's an essence everywhere that it recognizes, but gives the right note at the right time, in the right place, to each individual movement, based in that essence. So far, he's talked about the nature of the soul recognizing being and force. Now he moves on. But the most intimate character of the psychic is its pressure towards the divine through a sacred love, joy, and oneness. It is a divine love that it seeks most. It is the love of the divine that is its spur, its goal, its star of truth, shining over the luminous cave of the nascent or the still obscure cradle of the newborn Godhead within us. So, this demands a little bit of context. Because Sri Aurobindo has written in the sevenfold court of being in the life divine about where the soul is in the nature of things, absolutely. So if above there is an unknown, an unknowable, a supreme being that expresses itself positively as Satchit Ananda, truth of existence, truth of consciousness force, truth of Ananda, then a connecting world in which that oneness is distributed into manifold creation, manifestation, that would be the supramental realm, which draws the power of Satchit Ananda and distributes it in oneness into manifestation. And then from the supramental, in descending cords of being, we have mind, life, and matter. So, if matter hides ultimately the secret truth of existence, if life hides within itself the ultimate truth of power, of force, of will, if mind hides within itself the ascending power of the supramental consciousness, then where does Ananda come in? It comes in the power of the soul, the universal soul, the individual soul, the psychic being is that which expresses Ananda. And it is always here to taste in the joy of creation the secret truth of that hidden divine, which is multiformal. So bliss is the very nature of the soul. The seed of bliss in nature is the psychic being. So the oneness of delight is that which we pursue through the experience of love. It is love that brings us into oneness with that which we seek. Love is an expression of Ananda. It is a divine love that it seeks most. It is the love of the divine that is its spur, its goal, its star of truth, shining over the luminous cave of the nascent or the still obscure cradle of the newborn Godhead within us. So the psychic, as we begin to become aware of it, is that small flame again, that child, that eternal child, playing an eternal game in an eternal garden, the Godhead that is within us. Is the same as that Godhead above. In the first long stage of its growth and immature existence, it has leaned on earthly love, affection, tenderness, goodwill, compassion, benevolence, on all beauty and gentleness and fineness and light and strength and courage, on all that can help to refine and purify the grossness and commonness of human nature. But it knows how mixed are these human movements at their best and at their worst, how fallen and stamped with the mark of ego and self-deceptive sentimental falsehood, and the lower self profiting by the imitation of a soul movement. At once emerging, it is ready and eager to break all the old ties and imperfect emotional activities and replace them by a greater spiritual truth of love and oneness. It may still admit the human forms and movements, but on condition that they are turned towards the One alone. It accepts only the ties that are helpful, the heart's and mind's reverence for the Guru, the union of the God-seekers, a spiritual compassion for this ignorant human and animal world and its peoples, the joy and happiness and satisfaction of beauty that comes from the perception of the divine everywhere. It plunges the nature inward towards its meeting with the immanent divine in the heart's secret center. And while that call is there, no reproach of egoism, no mere outward summons of altruism or duty or philanthropy or service will deceive or divert it from its sacred longing and its obedience to the attraction of the divinity within it. It lifts the being towards a transcendent ecstasy and is ready to shed all the downward pull of the world from its wings in its uprising to reach the One Highest. But it calls down also this transcendent love and beatitude to deliver and transform this world of hatred and strife and division and darkness and jarring ignorance. It opens to a universal divine love, a vast compassion, an intense and immense will for the good of all, for the embrace of the World Mother, enveloping or gathering to her her children. The divine passion that has plunged into the night for the redemption of the world from the universal inconscience. It is not attracted or misled by mental imitations or any vital misuse of these great deep-seated truths of existence. It exposes them with its detecting search ray and calls down the entire truth of divine love to heal these malformations, to deliver mental, vital, physical love from their insufficiencies or their perversions, and reveal to them their true abounding share of the intimacy and the oneness, the ascending ecstasy and the descending rapture. So he writes here about the emerging psychic being. So finding inside the individual truth of our nature, the discovery of the divine made individual, of the immanent divine, of the union of the God-seekers. So, our fellow souls aspiring discover each other and work in commonalty. An immanent divine, that is, everywhere we cast our gaze, we see only that. Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram. We see it. Is that which is true being? Is that which is auspicious? Is that which is beautiful? Because it has that divine essence inside it. So this section that we've just read recalls the last sentence of the book, The Mother. Remember, he wrote that in, let's say, 1928. And he's writing these lines as he reformulates the synthesis of yoga, or this section of it, around 1932. wouldn't be published till 1948, so these words were not seen for another 16 years. We read what he had to say in The Life Divine long before we got to read what he said in Synthesis of Yoga in this revision. But here is that last sentence in the Mother. The Mother's power, and not any human endeavor and tapasya, can alone rend the lid and tear the covering and shape the vessel and bring down into this world of obscurity and falsehood and death and suffering truth and light and life divine and the immortals Ananda. These lines here in the Synthesis of Yoga capture some of that. It's a resonance from what he had already written in the book, The Mother. All true truth of love and of the works of love, the psychic being accepts in their place. But its flame mounts always upward, and it is eager to push the ascent from lesser to higher degrees of truth, since it knows that only by the ascent to a highest truth and the descent of that highest truth can love be delivered from the cross and placed upon the throne. For the cross is the sign of the divine descent, barred and marred by the transversal line of a cosmic deformation, which turns it into a stake of suffering and misfortune. Only by the ascent to the original truth can the deformation be healed, and all the works of love, as too all the works of knowledge and of life, be restored to a divine significance and become part of an integral spiritual existence. So this symbol this meeting of the ascending line and of the horizontal line join at a point, and the human ego is a point of suffering where the transcendent, the fall into the obscurity of the universe, regrets its choice. But to the soul, that point of connection where universe, the horizontal line, meets the descent and the ascent of the soul, that is the point at which spirit and matter marry. The individual awakened to the soul is the point of regeneration and redemption for the entirety of the cosmos. So this redemptive power embedded in the force of evolution as consciousness emerges from unconsciousness, as fragmentation moves back towards unity, is the whole journey of what we call the human spirit. And the ascent of the sacrifice is the arc of that journey. So next week, on the 18th, which comes after Surya Aurobindo's birthday on the 15th, we take up the next chapter, which is the ascent of the sacrifice to the works of love, because we've just begun, and the works of life. By the way, if you have an interest on the 15th, for those of you who can't be with us physically in Pensacola, we'll have something arranged for people to come in on Zoom if they want, both in morning and in evening. So this is a section from Savitri, and there are many sections in Savitri in which the emergence of the soul power is expressed in stirring language, and we'll read them all. This one tonight. Is in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 14, The World Soul. We're going to begin on page 291. All there was soul, or made of sheer soul stuff. A sky of soul covered a deep soul ground. All here was known by a spiritual sense. Thought was not there, but a knowledge near and one, seized on all things by a moved identity. A sympathy of self with other selves, the touch of consciousness on consciousness, and being's look on being with inmost gaze, and heart laid bare to heart without walls of speech, and the unanimity of seeing minds in myriad forms, luminous with the one God. Life was not there, but an impassioned force, finer than fineness, deeper than the deeps, felt as a subtle and spiritual power, a quivering out from soul to answering soul, a mystic movement, a close influence, a free and happy and intense approach of being to being with no screen or check, without which life and love could never have been. Body was not there, for bodies were needed not. The soul itself was its own deathless form, and met at once the touch of other souls, close, blissful, concrete, wonderfully true. As when one walks in sleep through luminous dreams, and conscious knows the truth their figures mean, here, where reality was its own dream, he knew things by their soul and not their shape. As those who have lived long, made one in love, need word nor sign for heart's reply to heart, he met and communed without bar of speech with beings unveiled by a material frame. There was a strange spiritual scenery, a loveliness of lakes and streams and hills, a flow, a fixity in a soul space, and plains and valleys, stretches of soul joy, and gardens that were flower tracts of the spirit, its meditations of tinged reverie. Air was the breath of a pure infinite. A fragrance wandered in a colored haze, as if the scent and hue of all sweet flowers had mingled to copy heaven's atmosphere. Appealing to the soul and not the eye, beauty lived there at home in her own house. There, all was beautiful by its own right and needed not the splendor of a robe. All objects were like bodies of the gods. A spirit symbol environing a soul, for world and self were one reality. So let us bring that soul stuff here. Let us make this concrete on our earth. Much love to you all. Namaste, Jai Ma.